And now we're speaking with Belgian theoretical physicist, philosopher of science, and a professor at the Université Catholique de Louvain, Jean Bricmont. He is the author, with Alan Sokal, of Fashionable Nonsense, a critique of relativism in philosophy, and he's also been a featured guest on our program to discuss his book, Humanitarian Imperialism, Using Human Rights to Sell War. It's an incredibly relevant book right now. It's published by Monthly Review, and I highly recommend that you pick it up in order to understand what is happening now. Jean, thank you very much for being on our program today.
Thank you. Thank you, Brendan.
It really is a pleasure. As I was saying just before the interview, I read your article as soon as it came out on Counterpunch. I'm an avid reader, and on March 8, as soon as I woke up, your article popped up. It was called "The Old Gang's All Here, Libya and the Return of Humanitarian Imperialism." And I have to say, you were right. You had this warning of the danger of humanitarian intervention, a military operation to change the regime in Libya. Tell me, what tipped you off? What indicated to you that we were headed for another humanitarian intervention?
Well, I mean, it's enough to see what the media say, what the political parties, especially on the left. You see, you could see the build-up for war exactly like in the Kosovo. At the time of the Kosovo, I did not believe that there would be war, but now I've gotten used to it, let's put it like that. And there is a hated dictator. A totally demonized dictator. Sometimes they say that Gaddafi has been collaborating with the West on various issues, but that does not mean that the media have not constantly portrayed him as, you know, beyond the pale. He's been always very consistently anti-Israeli. He has been anti-imperialist in Africa. I mean, rightly or wrongly, that's a separate question, but at least he looks really not our kind of guy. And of course, he's a dictator, and he's extravagant and so on, so he's very easy to demonize. And so there was a crisis there, and then you see everybody shouting, let's intervene, no more Rwanda, no more Srebrenica, etc. I did not expect the Security Council to endorse that, by the way, at that time. I could not forecast that, but...
It was surprising that China and Russia abstained from that vote. Certainly, Security Council gave a resolution that enabled certain things. Already within one or two days, France, the United States, the UK have even stepped beyond that resolution.
Of course. Because, you see, once you do this resolution and you add every means to protect the civilians, then it's open-ended. You can bomb Gaddafi, you can kill him, you can kill his children. I mean, it's open-ended. The resolution is ambiguous in that respect because it clearly prevents ground troops. On the other hand, it speaks of all the means necessary. And so it's ambiguous. And I suppose it was a result of negotiations. I don't know.
Yes, I've read that it was a condition for the U.S. participation that it be ambiguous, that it enabled just about anything. But we're going to get more information about that as time goes on. I guess right now, it seems to me that the role of the left, the Western left in particular, in West Europe, perhaps in Canada and the United States, the reaction of the anti-war movement is important here. Many seem to be focusing on whether or not Gaddafi deserves support, when perhaps the real question was, what are we doing to prevent NATO from attacking?
Yeah, of course, that's the eternal problem, you see. They always phrase it in the terminology of the adversary. When Bertrand Russell, for example, was opposed to World War I, he was always framed as a supporter of the Germans. If you oppose war, you're always framed as a supporter of the enemy. And the left accept this terminology and then say, should we support Gaddafi or should not support Gaddafi? But you see, if I don't want to wage war on a country, that doesn't mean I support it. I certainly don't want to wage war on the United States because it would lose it. I don't want to wage war on Israel for similar reasons. I mean, you cannot be opposed to war for various reasons, but just being opposed to war on a given country does not mean you support its government in the sense that you like it, you find it nice, etc. You may be opposed to war. In my case, I'm opposed to war because of a broader picture. I don't agree that it's all a matter of protecting civilians. First of all, there is an armed insurrection there, so let's not talk only about civilians. If the United States and Israel know how to suppress an insurrection, which they do outside of their borders, by the way, but if they know how to suppress an insurrection without harming civilians, why don't they show us how to do it in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Lebanon, and in Gaza?
Well, we faced the same issues in Iraq. People were being painted as being pro-Saddam, pro-government.
Yeah, of course, of of course, they always say that. And then, of course, once you accept that rhetoric, you see, but then I'm pro-Israel, I'm pro-US, I'm pro-Russia, I'm pro-every country I don't want to attack.
Yes.
I mean, it makes no sense.
Basically, it means that people are arguing within a rhetorical framework that's created by the military interventionists.
Of course. They accept the framework. And then they phrase the issue, you see, in purely moralistic terms. During World War One, for example, Russell tells that story. He got a picture of Belgian citizens or children who were badly treated by the Germans. Somebody said, what do you do to protect those people? Well, that's one side of the question. That's not the only question. The question is that if we go to war, what are the consequences of war? What are the consequences on the rest of the world? What are people going to think of us? What will Africa think? You see, there are all kinds of issues. I mean, what about international law? Do we care at all about the destruction of international law that this intervention entails? Namely, you know, in principle, the resolution says that if there are violations of human rights or a conflict or a civil war somewhere, anybody can intervene and put a no-fly zone. Of course, it's not true. It's not anybody. It's only the big powers and the powers who have enough power in the Security Council.
There's another matter related to this. You know, there was this discussion of saving Benghazi as if Gaddafi were invading Benghazi, even though it's part of Libya. So do you think is this like a shift in ideology towards policing the internal affairs of states rather than looking
of
at...
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I think the basic ideology, and I see that in all... For example, I've seen lots of statements against the war by individual French, but none of them refers to international law. Almost none of them. You see, international law is a concern of Latin Americans, but it's not a concern here. It doesn't exist. I mean, people, if you say international law, then they say, oh, but the dictators use that to repress their population, so we don't want to hear about it. And that's the knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, nobody has sovereignty. It seems that if there's an opposition movement in a country that the U.S. can label as a dictatorship, a country that the U.S. doesn't like, they can give a lot of airplay, a lot of coverage to that opposition, to an insurgency, and any attack that happens in that country, any civil war, then becomes a justification for a full-scale military intervention.
Yeah, they've been building up the case. You see, in Kosovo, the argument was the same, but there was no endorsement of the Security Council. Then, in Afghanistan and Iraq, the argument was rather security, but nevertheless, in the left, the lack of opposition was human rights, you see. We have to save the Afghan women, we have to save the Kurds, we have to save the overthrow Gaddafi, Saddam, etc. On the right, the argument, or in the US side, the argument there was not humanitarian, but was security issues, which would be more traditional, actually. But this new issue of going to war for human rights, that was the argument on the left, and that was the argument that was handicapped the peace movement or the anti-war movement. Now, in the case of Libya, I think it's the worst, because in the case of Libya, there is endorsement of the Security Council, which means that legal but with restrictions that are violated. But you see, that's the fine print. I mean, once you say, okay, go to war, all the media, nobody in the media are going to say, oh, but you violate the letter of the resolution.
Well,
that's
the problem with a no-fly zone is that it enables all sorts of activities following from that no-fly zone. It's an act of war, and the U.S. military leadership...
Of course, it's an act of war, but you see, bombing Tripoli, bombing tanks and so on, it goes way beyond. I don't see why bombing tanks is necessary for a no-fly zone.
Well, we have to prevent those tanks from flying.
Yeah, but you see, they go beyond that, and they know they go beyond that, and of course they go beyond that because the rebels would like, in fact... You know, the intervening powers to be their air force on their way to Tripoli.
Yes, and that's a very interesting issue because you have this opposition in Libya. And as far as I can tell, we didn't know a lot about this opposition. There's multiple groups in Libya. They have different objectives. There's a civil war, a two or more way civil war going on there. It seems the left in Western Europe and in Canada, was it doing its job? If there's people that are in armed activities within a state and they're calling themselves revolutionaries or they're calling themselves a democratic movement, I guess it's... Who are these people?
The problem is that I would rather not commit myself to either support or not support them. The issue basically is the one of international law and who is going to do the intervention. If we intervene, then why not Russia? Why not Iran? Why not Turkey? You see, that's the basic issue. If other countries intervene as they like, then international law is destroyed and we have the war of all against all. It seems to me that that is the bit more basic issue than knowing what the rebels are. Knowing whom the rebels are is a question that I think would be wise to ask from the Western government. But they probably figure out that they'd be able to control them afterwards, but that may not be so easy.
And what you're advocating is don't get involved at all, that we should keep our governments away from it. You've made a distinction as well between the Western left and that of Latin America, the Bolivarian Revolution, yeah, Chavez, Cuba, and so forth. You know, they seem to have taken a consistent position against intervention from the very beginning. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, you see, they are in power. Those who are in power are in power. So they have a large mass-based support. And I found it extraordinarily irritating to see this European left, which in some cases don't represent anybody, don't have 1% of the vote, and they are unbelievably arrogant with respect to Latin Americans, and they don't even try to understand why the Latin American thing for peace, no intervention. So this left, which is always open-minded and anti-racist and internationalist, doesn't bother to want to ask itself why do these other people, dark-skinned people, take the position they have, because the African Union also has this position, the Arab League is wavering, etc., etc., and China is consistently, and India is against, everybody is against. You understand? To me, it's obvious that the people who have been on the wrong side of intervention for centuries will be opposed to intervention no matter what. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that, left, which has achieved, which has managed to win election, this left, the funny thing is also on this Western left, they always claim to support Chavez and to support the Bolivarian Revolution and process and blah, blah, blah. Although the people in Latin America do very well without the Western European left, because the Western European left has no power. The same way they support the insurrection in Libya, nobody cares what they support because it doesn't have any effect. But on the other hand, as I say, they shouldn't support, they should learn from them. They should try to understand what it means to do politics, to have an agenda, and to have priorities. And the priority of the Latin American left is no intervention, to be able to pursue their own reform and their own transformation without outside interference.
Well, Fidel Castro had been very consistent in warning about the dangers, and Chavez had been advocating against an attack on Libya for weeks before the attack. There's a lot of people here that talk about solidarity with Venezuela, solidarity with Cuba, with Latin America. But it seems to me, Chavez asked for help. He asked people to condemn the intervention or to get behind negotiated settlements with Latin America and other countries involved. But that didn't happen. In some ways, people were infantilizing Chavez. They were saying that, Chavez, Castro, Ortega, they're supporting Gaddafi, and it's because they don't know any better. They're misguided because of past connections.
I know. Well, I think that apart from one or two sentences, which are debatable, I think by and large, what they supported is a negotiated settlement and also an active role of the UN. The UN, you see, in the old days, the UN would send a peacekeeping force or it would send observers and it would try to report on the fact on the ground without relying on the newspapers, the Western newspapers. But now, that's what they do, basically. And it's sort of amazing that it's totally been hijacked by the Western powers.
Well, in terms of what people can do here, in solidarity, in being supportive of the ideas of some of the Latin American governments, I guess it comes down to a politics of what activists can do to resist these wars.
But it seems to me that the Latin American left offers you an easy way out, or an easy, not way out, but an easy program to follow. You see, you could just advocate what they advocate and say that this is also the African Union and it's that sometimes it's also part of the Arab League, etc., etc. And then you should stick to that position because eventually, you see, even if the rebel force win, there might be resistance. You see, Libya is not such a united country, it seems. So there might be conflicts like there are in Iraq or conflicts like there are in Afghanistan. So are we going to be dragged in those conflicts for ages? And if we do, then eventually you will have to have negotiations. Like we certainly will have to have negotiations in Afghanistan with the Taliban eventually, even though they refuse to have them. They refuse to have negotiations with Palestinians for decades, and in the end they had them. So when they will have negotiation, you can come back and say, hey, we suggested it right from the beginning. All these wars end up in negotiations. I'm very doubtful that, you know, I expect, of course, the Gaddafi regime to fall, but I'm not sure it will fall easily, and even if it falls easily, I'm not sure the problems will be solved. And I'm sure that if they are solved, then we'll go for new wars, because then there'll be complete hysteria about, you know, like after Kosovo, there'll be complete hysteria on the pro-war camp saying, ah, we won, and we are the savior of mankind, and we have to go on and on and on. And to a large extent in Britain, for example, the involvement in Iraq was a sequel of the success in Kosovo, because the victory in Kosovo, you know, made them completely crazy about intervention, made Blair and his...
In many ways, it's been suggested that one purpose of this attack on Libya is to bring back humanitarian intervention, to re-legitimize
it. Yeah, I think that's maybe... Yeah, that's part of the reason. I mean, I don't know what the reason is, but that's a plausible enough reason. I mean, they may... You see... I think humanitarian intervention was discredited with Afghanistan and Iraq. But the humanitarian interventionists can say, oh, but these were the neocons. They were the bad guys, and they invented reasons to intervene that were not humanitarian but were linked to security, which actually is more legitimate in my view, not in that case, but in principle, I think a state could defend its security if it's really threatened, of course. But they, you know... Then they want indeed to say, now it's different. It's not like Iraq. It's humanitarian, okay? So there's this whole, the whole industry of humanitarian intervention is back. Yeah, exactly. And I saw that coming. That was completely obvious by just looking at Facebook or looking at the web and so on. I mean, everybody was shouting.
Yes. Well, absolutely. It's why more people have to read your book, Humanitarian Imperialism. And we'll mention that again. So, Jean, thanks very much. We appreciate
that. Thank you very much, Brian.
I know it's late at night, and thanks for being with us.
No, that's okay.